This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule, or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
Lindsay Moore here.
I'm Gus Allen.
My name is Janine Denning.
Hi, this is Hannah Sullivan.
Hi, I'm Michelle Corbett.
Hello, this is Sandra Shelton. Death Coach, a New York ghost story, retold by S.C. Schlosser. It is midnight. The streets of Coho's grow silent as the citizens turn off their lights one by one and go to their well-earned rest. The night is dark and the wind whispers softly, touching the trees and houses, rattling a windowpane here and there. In one house, a woman sits beside her window, waiting silently for the doctor to arrive. Her beloved husband lies on the bed next to her. In the light of a single candle, she can see his emaciated face. He is in terrible pain, which even the drugs prescribed by the doctor cannot abate. She clutches his hand tightly, feeling the cold creeping through it. He is barely breathing now. She knows he is slipping away. One part of her is thankful, for she cannot bear to see him in so much pain. Most of her wants to scream out in desperation, begging him not to leave her. Outside the house, the soft rumble of wheels and the clip-clop of hooves echo through the still night. The woman tears her eyes from her husband's face and looks out the window, expecting to see the doctor's curricle pulling into the street. Instead, she sees a dark, closed coach with black gaping holes where the windows should be. The shafts at the front of the coach are empty, yet she can hear the sound of invisible horses' hoofs as the coach moves slowly down the street. She draws in a deep breath and exhales slowly. It is the death coach. Her husband had told her it would come for him that night, but she hadn't believed him, hadn't wanted to believe him. Yet there it is, rolling slowly up to the front of the house to stop by the front gate. The sight terrifies her, and she clutches her husband's hand tightly. He opens his eyes and smiles feebly at her, trying to squeeze her hand. "Is it here?" he asks, his voice barely a whisper. She nods. "I love you," he says to his wife. She leans down and kisses him, feels his last breath on her lips. The grip on her hand loosens, and she knows he is dead. She straightens up, looking tenderly at his dead face through her tears. A movement by the door causes her to look up. She sees her husband's spirit standing at the door. He gazes first at his dead body and then smiles at her. Then he turns and walks down the stairs. She moves at once to the window, flinging it open and leaning out, hoping to see him again. The front door opens and her husband steps out onto the front porch and walks slowly to the death coach. The door opens and he pauses for a moment to look towards the window, knowing she is watching. He waves and she waves back, tears streaming down her face. Then her husband steps into the coach and the door closes behind him. Slowly, the death coach rumbles down the street, turns a corner, and is gone. "Goodbye, my love," she calls softly as the death coach disappears. Her husband's pain is over, but hers has just begun. With a heavy heart, she closes the window and goes down the stairs to telephone the doctor and tell him her husband is dead.
Piece by Piece, a New York ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. There once was a crazy ghost over Poughkeepsie Way that got folks so plumb scared that nobody would stay more than one night in its house. It was a nice old place, or was, until the ghost began making its presence known. It got so no one would enter the house, not even kids on a dare, and you know what they are like. Now, when my friend Joe heard a fancy house in Poughkeepsie was selling dirt cheap, he decided to go have a look. He asked me about it, and I told him about the spook. But Joe just laughed. "I don't believe in ghosts," he said, and went to visit the agent selling the house. Well, the agent gave Joe a key, but refused to look at the house with him, which should have told Joe something. But Joe's a stubborn man who won't listen to reason. He even waited until after dark to visit the house for the first time, just to prove his point. Joe got to the house around 9 p.m., and he entered the front hallway. It was a large entrance and well-proportioned, but neglected-looking, with creepy cobwebs and dust everywhere. As Joe paused near the door to get his bearings, he heard a thump from the top of the staircase facing him. A glowing leg appeared out of nowhere and rolled down the steps, landing right next to Joe's feet. Joe gasped out loud and stood frozen to the spot. An arm appeared and rolled down to meet the leg. Next came a foot, then another arm, then a hand. Glowing pieces of body kept popping into existence and plummeting down the stairs towards Joe. Joe held his ground a lot longer than anyone else ever had, but when a screaming head appeared at the top of the stairs and started rolling towards him, Joe had had enough. With a shriek that could wake the dead, those that weren't already up and haunting the house, that is, Joe ran for his life. Out of the house, out of the street, and right out of town, leaving his car behind him. He called me the next day and asked me to drive his car down to the hotel where he had spent the night. Joe was heading back to Manhattan and refused to come within 50 miles of Poughkeepsie ever again. The agent gave up trying to sell the house after that, and the house fell into ruin and was eventually torn down.
The Headless Sentry, taken from Spooky South Carolina, retold by S. E. Schlosser. A wealthy businessman who worked behind the political scenes, both in Georgetown and in Charleston, owned a large plantation just outside Charleston. He often entertained business and political associates at the Manor House, influential men who came from other colonies and abroad. When war broke out between America and England, the owner was reluctant to take sides, for his business was primarily supported by England. Not so his family, who were actively engaged in the Revolution. The plantation owner did not stay on the fence for long, though. When the British occupied Georgetown and made it a stronghold and supply base for their military operations, he declared himself a Tory, much to the wrath of his family, who labeled him a traitor. His daughter, in particular, was angered by his stance, for she was strictly loyal to the colonies. Still, she kept a low profile, for she was living in her father's house, and became a spy for General Francis Marion. It was due to the girl's alertness and the information that she gathered and furnished for the Swamp Fox that so many of the general's exploits met with success. The family owned a house in Georgetown that adjoined the cemetery of Prince George Church, and it was in a vault in that cemetery that the girl spy left messages. And one of those messages contained vital information about a prisoner of war who was being held at the plantation. The prisoner was an old fellow, father to one of the trusted men in Marion's brigade, who had been present when many of the plans and strategies for some of the local operations had been formulated. Due to his age and infirmity, the Swamp Fox was afraid that the old man might unknowingly furnish the enemy with damaging information in a moment of confusion. It was vitally important that he be rescued and taken beyond the reach of his captors. The girl spy had arranged to visit the plantation to obtain supplies for her townhouse, though her real aim was to locate the old man. She found him lodged in the plantation house along with his wife and several wounded soldiers. In order to give Marion and his men time to retrieve the prisoner, the girl had the soldiers guarding the plantation invited to a reception at a neighboring estate. There was only one sentry left on guard the evening that the Swamp Fox and his men came thundering down the avenue of the plantation. The sentry, thinking they were British soldiers arriving from town, ran down the steps to greet them. The Americans were almost upon him when the sentry recognized Marion's men. He fired his pistol at the nearest horseman, who was already aiming at him. Both shots missed, but a saber-wielding cavalryman promptly cut off the sentry's head, leaving his body to stagger around, spouting blood like a decapitated chicken before it fell, twitching to the ground amidst a growing pool of gore. The prisoners were retrieved and taken back to Marion's camp, along with the wounded British and Tory soldiers housed at the plantation, who were held as prisoners of war. As for the headless sentry, he was buried in the garden near the old plantation house. Ever since the death of the sentry, folks wandering the plantation grounds at dusk have sometimes heard the thunder of the phantom hooves coming up the long avenue. Moments later, a headless man dressed in the clothes of a British dragoon appears near the house, the ragged stump of his neck spouting blood. The headless sentry waves his pistol aimlessly as if trying to warn off trespassers, and then drags himself away as if searching for its head. Anyone encountering the headless sentry in this manner would flee in terror, and soon word of the phantom was all over Charleston. As for the plantation workers, well, they started wearing crosses and other amulets to protect themselves when they were forced to walk the grounds after dark. Unfortunately, this did nothing to inhibit the specter, who still searches for his head to this day, though the plantation grounds are now covered by a golf course and a restaurant occupies part of the old manor house.
Ocean-Born Mary, a New Hampshire ghost story, retold by F. E. Schlosser. Elizabeth and James Wilson were Irish immigrants from Londonderry, Ireland. In 1720, they set sail for America. They had been granted some land in Londonderry, New Hampshire, and were hoping to start a new life there. As they neared Boston, Elizabeth went into labor and gave birth to a daughter. While she was giving birth, a strange vessel accosted the ship. They were fired upon and were forced to heave to. Their ship was boarded by a band of swarthy pirates. Their leader, a surprisingly young man, not yet 20 years of age, was dark, handsome, and ruthless. He was called Don Pedro, and his English was flawless as he ordered all the captives killed. At this fatal juncture, the cries of a newborn baby could be heard from down in the hold. Startled, Don Pedro ordered the captain to take him to the child. After gazing for a long time at the tiny girl, Don Pedro said to Elizabeth, "If you name this child after my mother, Mary, I will spare the lives of everyone on this ship." Frightened by the fierce pirate, Elizabeth hastily agreed. Don Pedro sent one of his men back to the pirate ship. When the man returned, he was carrying an armload of gifts. Don Pedro presented these gifts to Elizabeth. Fingering a green brocade silk with an odd look of tenderness on his ruthless face, he said, "This is for my Mary's wedding dress." Then he and his men returned to their ship and departed. Soon after their ship landed safely in Boston, James Wilson died. His widow and daughter went to Londonderry to claim the land in his name. Ocean-born Mary grew into a tall, beautiful, red-haired woman. In 1742, wearing a green brocade gown made from the silk given to her by Don Pedro, Mary was married to James Wallace. They had 5 children, 4 sons, and a daughter. Sadly, after the birth of his 4th son, James Wallace died. Around that time, Don Pedro, having retired from the sea, decided to build a home in New Hampshire. Having never forgotten his little ocean-born Mary, Don Pedro began seeking to discover what became of her. Finding her a widow in Londonderry, he married her and brought her and her children to live in his grand mansion in Henniker. He gifted Mary with a stately coach and 4, in which Mary would often be seen riding around the countryside. One by one, her sons grew up, married, and settled down near Mary. One day, coming in from an errand to town, Mary saw Don Pedro and one of his retired pirates carrying a large black trunk to the orchard in back. She heard the sounds of digging and then silence. Don Pedro came back to the house alone, and they never spoke of the matter. But later, he told Mary that when he died, she should bury him and the treasure under the hearthstone. A year later, Mary came home one evening to an empty house. She started searching for her husband and found Don Pedro in the orchard, stabbed to death with a cutlass. Mary buried Don Pedro with his treasure under the hearthstone, and there they lay to this day. After her death in 1814, Mary's ghost began to haunt the house where she had once lived with her pirate husband. People would see a tall, beautiful red-haired woman come walking down the long staircase. Sometimes she could be seen standing beside an upper window or throwing something down the well. Others had witnessed Mary's driving in her coach and 4 up to the front door of the house. The house was finally abandoned and later torn down, although the house where her son Robert lived still stands and is sometimes called the Ocean-Born Mary House.
Girl in White, a Mexican Ghost Story, as retold by S. E. Schlosser. He was sulking a little, standing at the sidelines while all the other men danced with their pretty partners. His girl had not come to the dance that night. Her mother was ill, and so his girl had remained at her side. A fine, pious act, he thought sourly, but it left him at loose ends. His friend Ernesto came up to him between sets with a cold drink and some words of encouragement. "After all, Anita is not the only girl in the world," Ernesto said. "There are many pretty girls here tonight. Dance with one of them." Bolstered by his friend's words, he started looking around the dance hall. His eyes fell upon a beautiful young girl standing wistfully at the edge of the floor beside the door to the terrace. She was dressed in an old-fashioned white gown, and her skin was as pale as the moon. Her dark eyes watched the dance hungrily from her position behind a tall fern, and he felt his heart beat faster. Such a lovely woman should be dancing. He made his way through the bustling crowd and bowed to the girl in white. She looked startled by his addresses, as if she had not expected anyone to notice her that night. But she readily assented to dance with him, and he proudly led her out onto the floor for the next set, all thoughts of Anita gone from his mind. Ernesto and some of his other friends gave him odd looks as he danced with the girl in white. A few times, the man opposite them bumped right into them, as if he had not seen his partner at all. He was furious and wanted to stop the dance and make the man apologize to the girl in white, but she just laughed and hushed him. When the dance was over, he hurried to get his fair partner a drink. Ernesto approached him at the refreshment table. "When I told you to dance, I meant with a partner," his friend teased him. "I was dancing with a partner," he replied, irritated by his friend's remark. "The loveliest girl in all of Mexico." "You've had too much to drink, my friend," Ernesto replied. "You were dancing by yourself out there." He glared at his friend and turned away without answering him. Making his way back to the girl in white, he handed her a glass and asked her to stroll with him along the terrace. The night was beautiful, the sky full of stars, and he stared at the girl in white with his heart in his eyes as they stood looking out over the beautiful scene. The girl in white turned to him with a sigh and said, "Thank you for the dance, Signor. It has been a very long time since I had such pleasure." "Let us dance again, then," he said, clearly infatuated. But she shook her head. "I must leave now," she said, catching up her skirts with one hand and drifting toward the stairs at the side of the terrace. "Please don't go," he pleaded, following her. "I must," she said, turning to look at him. Her eyes softened when she saw the look on his face. "Come with me?" she invited, holding out a pale hand. His heart pounded rapidly at the thought. More than anything in the world, he wanted to go with this lovely girl. And then his mind registered the fact that he could see the stone wall of the terrace through the girl's hand. His desire melted away with the shock of that realization. He looked into her face again and realized that she was fading away before his eyes. At the look of horror on his face, the girl gave a sad laugh and dropped her hand, which was nearly transparent now. "Goodbye," she said, her body becoming thin and misty. "Goodbye." Then she was gone. He gave a shout of terror when he realized he had been dancing with a ghost. He bolted from the premises, leaving his horse behind, and ran all the way home. When Ernesto came the next day to bring him his horse, he told his friend the whole story. Ernesto whistled in awe. "You saw the spirit of Consuela, my friend," he said. "She was the daughter of one of the local aristocracy who lived in this region more than 100 years ago. She died of consumption the night before her first ball, and they say her spirit sometimes attends the local dances, hoping to claim one of the dances that she missed." He shuddered at the thought of this dance with the ghost. "I will not be visiting that dance hall again," he told Ernesto. "From now on, all my dances will be with Anita." And he kept his word.
A Florida Folktale, retold by S.E. Schlosser. She was always in the garden, day after day after day. It drove him crazy. Supper never came when he wanted it, and he had to go outside and kneel down in the dirt every dad-blamed time he wanted to have a conversation with his wife. When he complained, she told him to get his own supper. Ha! She knew he couldn't boil water without burning it. The garden wasn't the only thing that drove him crazy. His wife also loved the color pink. She wore something pink every dad-blamed day of her life, and most of the flowers in the garden were pink. "Choose another color," he yelled one day. So what color did she choose? Mauve. One day, his wife started complaining about her knees. She wanted an assistant to help her in the garden. "Why do you need an assistant?" he grumbled at her. "Do you want to help me?" she retorted. "Heck no," he replied, and told her to go ahead and hire a gardener. He didn't expect the handsome young fellow, who showed up the next day, to help his wife in the garden. The fellow had a charming manner that soon had his wife laughing and fluffing up her hair as they talked. That drove him really crazy. Some folks might think it was natural for her to find the new gardener charming, but he wondered. He started coming home early from work to spy on his wife and the new gardener. They were always laughing together as they worked. He didn't like it. Then his wife went out and bought a brand new red lipstick, though she'd only ever bought pink lipstick before, and got her hair cut in a new style. That made him suspicious. He spoke to the new gardener one afternoon while his wife was out. The young man denied that there was any hanky-panky going on, but he knew better, and fired the gardener on the spot. At supper that night, he confronted his wife with his suspicions. "I'm not having an affair," she retorted, "but if you keep this up, he could get lucky." Her smart reply filled him with rage. His vision went red and misty as his hands closed around his wife's neck, and he started shaking her. It was several minutes before he calmed down enough to realize he was shaking a rag doll figure that was no longer breathing. He dropped his wife's dead body on the floor in horror, realizing what he'd done and what would happen to him if he were caught. Fortunately, the dirt was always disturbed around his house because of his wife's gardening, so he dumped his wife's body into a flower bed and covered the grave mound with pink flower seedlings. End of problem. He closed the house the next day, telling the neighbors that they were going north to be with his wife's ailing sister, and put the house on the market to be sold. When 7 years had passed without suspicion, he decided it was safe to come home. He got an apartment and told folks that his wife had left him some time ago, but he was frightened of discovery and wanted to know if his wife was still buried in the flower bed of his former house. Waiting for the new owners to leave for the weekend, he slipped into the garden at dusk to look for the grave. To his horror, he saw the old mound was still there and was still planted with pink flowers. Only now, the pink flowers formed the shape of a woman. Trembling, he dug a deep, narrow hole into the mound, feeling for his wife's bones. But her body was gone. Alarmed, he made discreet inquiries and was told that the new owners had found a family gravesite on their property and had the grave moved to the local cemetery. He felt a surge of relief at this explanation, but morbid curiosity sent him along to the cemetery to check on the truth of the tale. He searched for a long time, looking for a grave with no name. Then he caught a glimmer of pink, and his pulses started pounding. Could it be? Yes, there was a narrow grave, covered with pink flowers. It had no name attached to it, and he knew it was her. In that moment, his vision was clouded once again by a red mist. He lurched as he was suddenly overwhelmed by a massive heart attack, and his helpless body tumbled down among the pink flowers as the whole world went dark. His last thought was of a dead rag doll figure that had once been his wife. After the authorities found and removed the dead body, the flowers crushed by his fall never grew back on the unmarked grave. Each spring, the unmarked tomb is covered with pink blossoms, though the flowers never grow in the blackened body-shaped space where the murderer's body lay. And in the house where the couple once lived, the pink flowers on the empty grave mound still grow each spring in the shape of a woman's body, no matter how many times the owners have rooted them out.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.